Hi, Mage fans. This is Terry Robinson with Mage the Podcast. And before we get to today's interviews, first, some notes. One, happy holidays from Mage the Podcast. Two, thank you to those of you who did holiday shopping using our Mage the Podcast affiliate code on DriveThruRPG. We get a small amount of each purchase made using our affiliate code, and that helps us cover costs. Third, Ascension's Landscape, how metaphysical choices guide world building in Mage the Ascension, will be on sale on Monday, December 30th on the Storyteller's Vault, and at least for the first week, will be Pay What You Want. This is a publication I'm putting out, and it's a supplement geared at storytellers to help think through why the world of darkness is dark and what game ideas can come from that. It also walks through questions on the metaphysics of Mage and how changes to those assumptions change the gaming world. Like, what does the world look like if Archmasters are more common, or if linear mages cooperate well with the Awakened, or if the traditions are poorly organized, or if Marauders are very rare and such, and it's riddled with story hooks and chronicle ideas. Today's show is the last of the interviews I did at PAX Unplugged in Philadelphia and includes a conversation with Matt McElroy of Onyx Path Publishing on what the rough breakdown is when you buy a $45 hardback supplement and what the economics of the publishing industry kind of look like. The second interview is with Travis Legg, prolific author on the Storyteller Vault, on his experience as a freelancer, what it's like running the Onyx Path Twitch channel, as well as a bunch of information about the upcoming supplement Technocracy Reloaded. And with that, here's the show.
This is Terry Robinson on location at PAX Unplugged in my backyard, talking with Mage the Podcast perennial favorite guest, Matt McElroy. How has your PAX been?
Oh, it's been amazing this year. Lots of demos. We debuted Trinity here at the show. We teased out some new books. People are super excited about Victorian Age Mage and Technocracy Reloaded. And Travis has been running some teaser demos. It's been an awesome show all around.
Awesome. So as I walk the show floor, one of the things I am constantly seeing is a 200 to 400 page hardback book being sold for exactly $45. That seems to be kind of a relative consistent across these booths. You are vastly more familiar with book production than I am. Can you give our listeners a very vague breakout of, for a $45 book, roughly where that $45 gets broken out to?
So a couple of things to consider is some of the books are what we call offset printing, where we pre-order anywhere from 500 to 5,000 copies of a book, and then the printer can give us a kind of a price break because they're doing so many copies. Okay. Other books are print on demand, where it's literally printing what is exactly ordered that day. And that's a much more expensive process, which is why print on demand books tend to be a little bit more, because you're trading the instant availability, the
on process,
yeah, and the fact that there's no storage and the publisher doesn't have to pay for those books in advance. When you're doing an offset run, you have to plan for that ahead of time, because even if you're getting a good deal, ordering 500, 5,000 books is super expensive, and all of that is coming up front.
And it seems to be there's been a change in the industry where each company used to have its own warehouse, and now you might have a warehousing company that would take care of
right.
that kind of stock management.
So like
for
we
you.
Use Studio 2 and Indie Press Revolution to store books for us because we don't have our own warehouse. So we have services that help us out in that regard. They also handle sales directly to stores and distributors and things like that for us. For example, Studio 2 is here at PAX doing all of our sales for us. So our booth doesn't have any retail. We're just running games. We're doing interviews and other fun stuff like that. We're letting our partners, Studio 2, who are frankly much more skilled at doing retail, sell the books for us. Luckily, we were right next door to them this year, so that worked out really well for us.
So when I see something like the Kickstarter, roughly the hardback costs somewhere between $40 and $50 after shipping.
Yeah.
And if I'm at the retailer tier, it's roughly half that. So I can get five books for like $120 or something
right.
if I'm part of the retail tier for a Kickstarter.
So traditionally, a publisher produces a book, they pay the printer for them, that goes to a distributor, they sell to retailer, and everybody wants to get paid.
Yeah.
So
if
you look at the $45 price, the retailer needs to make a certain amount of profit. The distributor needs to make a certain amount of profit. So if you're doing the subtraction, the publisher gets that much less.
Yeah. So I'm assuming on a $45 or $50 book, you are getting $20 or fewer for each copy that goes out the
door. That's a very good assumption, yeah.
Okay.
It really varies by book.
Yeah.
And
it's going to vary by licensing arrangement.
Yeah,
some of the stuff you have is in-house.
Because that could split the book four ways.
Okay.
If you think about it. Retailer, distributor, licensor, publisher. And we bear all of the expenses as hiring the writers, artists, editors, paying the printing up front. Sometimes with some warehouses, there's storage fees. Yeah. So the books are literally, we're renting the space.
Which I imagine is periodically why IPR does like a 50% off sale, because at that point it's better just to recoup your costs.
Especially
than to have
with
to pay
new books coming in.
Yeah.
We try and incentivize people to get their if they missed a Kickstarter, we try and offer some deals now and then when we can. And it's much less harder to do big discounts on print on demand because there's literally no inventory. So the price of that book there's never an opportunity to discount it because
there's no middleman or there's no additional layers that you can cut out.
And that printer, the on-demand printer, has a set fee and it's usually based on how big the book is, whether it's hardcover, softcover, black and white, color. There's lots of little factors that determine those prices.
That would explain why sometimes the print-on-demand copy, one book will be larger than another but be cheaper.
Right.
I imagine because maybe the large one is strictly black and white or...
Exactly. Okay. There's lots of... And it's really hard to generalize because there's so many variables that affect pricing models. But those are some, we'll call them the basic guidelines.
Okay. So we're down to a $20 for a hardback that we think we're going to sell between 500 and 1,000 of. Where does that go? I imagine that there are writers, editors, and so on that need to be split up.
Exactly. So writers get their rate, editors get their rate. Art is one of the most expensive parts of a game book. If it's a core book, we'll have an indexer, and they get a fee as well. And then the layout and graphic design, especially if we're creating new logos and things like that, that's all stuff that has to be created from scratch.
Okay.
And we want to pay people for their work.
So you have a new game that goes into development, so Deviant the Renegades or something like
that.
Exactly. And you want to have someone select, this is going to be the typography we use, this is the formatting and templating we use. Is that a one-time thing, or is that person then brought back for each subsequent book in the
line? So a lot of times we'll hire that person to design the look for a game.
Okay.
And then, of course, supplements will follow that core book's design.
I just assume Mike Chaney did everything.
He does amazing work, but sometimes he'll bring in specialists to design a logo, or the Chicago by Night logo was designed by Meredith Gerber. And Mike oversees all of that.
Okay.
But sometimes he wants to bring in a certain style for a specific project. But he does amazing work himself. He designs a lot of our logos. Rich does a lot of some logos and like the calling symbols in Pugmire or the clan symbols or things like that. So it really depends, again, per book, how that team is built. We look for what's going to be the best work for this particular project.
So it makes sense. So from what I understand, the writer, the editor, maybe the indexer, and the art is all kind of a per-piece rate. So the writer gets paid per word, the editor gets paid per word, the indexer gets paid maybe per page or per book, and the art is paid per piece. Is that...
Most of the time.
Okay.
But again, sometimes there's, we're going to pay you a flat fee for this many projects.
Okay.
Or... this particular book is going to be extra complicated, so we'll adjust the rate based on that. Or sometimes we'll say an artist didn't turn their stuff in on time, so we need a rush piece to get a book printed in time. So there's a rush fee involved. And that's all, if you think about it, that's all before we ever get any revenue coming in for that project. So we have to plan out how much is this going to cost us to produce and how much is it likely to sell.
And then in addition to that, you have a few people that are getting paid not on a piecemeal rate. So you have you run operations. It's not like you get paid per word or anything like
that.
So I assume there's some sort of, I don't want to quite say overhead, but some sort of...
That's exactly true. Because the whole process of running the company, we need to have the funds to run the company to make these things happen and have meetings with distributors and have talk to retailers and... plan our booth at conventions, and those expenses go into running the company as well.
So is it one of those things when you're considering new projects, is it always the marketability of it, or do you have the idea that, hey, we can do this as a niche product with certain roadmaps that we want to hit, or we want to sell it for a higher price because we think there's a select audience?
Definitely some of each. There's some stuff that's definitively a passion project that we think not only are we super excited to make, but we think the audience will really enjoy. And that... We probably know that some of those aren't going to be as popular as other ones, but we think there's a reason to make it, both for the creative reach and because the audience is super interested in that particular topic. and it gets them engaged and enthusiastic about the projects we're doing. And we know some game lines are going to have a much smaller audience than others. So, and that's part of where Kickstarter comes in and helps us fund those types of projects.
I mean, it's demand management. It gives you an idea. These are people who have literally put down their credit cards.
Yeah, because that helps us know how many books to print, for example. And we're not relying on an old method of printing thousands of copies, throwing them in the warehouse and hoping.
And then possibly pulping them at the end
exactly.
or something like that. Has the advent of like premier editions changed the economics of this at all? I have the doorstop version of the Mage Core, but I also have the nice leatherette version too.
Yeah.
And one costs four times the other one or something like
well,
that.
Well, that's another thing where Kickstarter came in really handy is it helps us assess how much of a demand there is for a fancy leatherette deluxe edition.
Premier Ducks Deluxe Pro Limited.
You know, for example, Changeling 20 did not get an ultra deluxe because we couldn't get enough backers to do it. So there was so much risk involved of printing something that expensive and fragile that we
decided. Was basically going to have a stained glass window in the front of it. Wasn't that the plan? Yeah.
So we needed to know for sure there was enough support for that type of project.
Yeah, the Italian village that produced that kind of leaded glass. It's not cheap to rent the entire neighborhood in Padua.
And that's one of the reasons we use Kickstarter that way. Is it really helps the audience engage with us on a early enough in the process to tell us what they're interested in. That's why we do fun stuff like during Dark Eras, people got to vote on which era was going to be the next stretch goal.
Okay,
we love that kind of back and forth dynamic feedback, and it tells us that at least we can get this book out in a very awesome, high quality process.
So we've talked about what are relatively traditional ways, plus the advent of Kickstarter. Do you feel there is a next step in the way in which RPGs are being produced?
Yeah, there's a lot of online play, like Astral Tabletop. I recommend everybody check that out. It's very similar to Roll20, and that's another one. We just rolled out the Scion Origin book in the new phone PDF format on DriveThruRPG, so that's a new format that we're experimenting with. You can also get Pugmire in the phone PDF. So we would love people to check those out and tell us what they like, use them at the table, and if they want other books in that format. That's really good feedback and super important because that's a brand new type of ebook. So we want to see how people are using that and what they think. Is our World of Darkness books something they want in a phone PDF, or do they prefer them in a different format? So give us the feedback. Let us know.
Has there been any discussion of doing like an SRD? A number of games will literally have a wiki-style webpage that is just the rules, absolutely no setting information. That way, when you're at the table, you can always be like, oh, crap, what are the rules for hacking a computer, breaking into a
thing? Yeah, that's definitely something we've looked at for a few games. Some of the stuff that's licensed, we don't own, so we can't just post another company's rule set online without their involvement and permission. So those are ongoing discussions that we're looking at. And for example, Story Path is still relatively new. Scion and Trinity are out now. Dystopia Rising and They Came From are on the way. So we got to see how the audience is using that system.
Okay.
And then we'll react and see how the best way to serve the Story Path audience is.
With the advent of print-on-demand, it seems like games now have a much longer tail than they used
to. Absolutely.
During the most recent sale, I bought a digital copy of a book that came out 25 years ago.
Yeah.
So is that just kind of considered to be dessert for the publisher, or is that something that is now being taken into consideration when a book's being planned?
It's definitely like we just did Aberrant First Edition in print-on-demand.
Okay.
Because there was enough demand and nostalgia from us launching the new Aberrant Kickstarter that I thought it would be a nice treat for Aberrant fans to be able to get a print copy of the first edition. So that was a cool project I was able to do. And that's not a book I would reprint, but print on demand makes it available for me to option that to people. And like the back White Wolf catalog on DriveThruRPG and Storytellers World having massive amounts of print on demand of old books is great for collectors. Or people that, like, I'm running, I call it VSR. It's, you know, like OSR for D&D.
Okay.
But it's Vampire First Edition.
Okay.
Only the core book. No other supplements exist. So in that WAD that there are, in that particular game I'm running, there's nothing beyond what's in the first edition book. And it's just fun that I was able to get a POD copy that I could hand around on the table, and we weren't all just using PDFs that way.
Now, that's one of those things where a number of those books still aren't available in print on demand. Is that just a thing that takes time, or does it need to get a certain number of digital sales?
No, it's a couple different factors. A lot of the especially first edition books were laid out pre-modern layout software, so okay. There are no digital files for them. Or they are, but they're in something like PageMaker or Quark that nobody knows how to open. So that means we have to find a high-quality secondary market copy to basically destroy, to scan.
Rip the spine off, scan it at high DPI.
Yeah, so and that takes a lot of work, and some of them are really hard to find, or at least hard to find a good enough quality copy for scanning. Because like I found a copy of Ashes to Ashes, for example.
That sounds vampire-y.
It was the first adventure for first edition vampire. And I couldn't find a quality that we could take apart to scan. There were people that had great quality copies, but they weren't going to let me destroy them.
Okay.
So that's part of it, too, is researching and shopping on secondary market and things like that, finding a copy that's good enough and destroyable, which is a hard combination to make happen.
Well, if you have a once list for Mage, we will make it happen.
All right.
I've got a bunch of people being like, ask McElroy when we're going to get print-on-demand 1E. I'm like, okay, sure.
But that's really been part of the holdup, especially the older the book is, because I also work a little bit on the DM's Guild team on Drive-Thru, and we've been doing the same project on all of the Dungeons & Dragons books. And the older a book is, the harder it is to find a good copy. Or you find a copy, but it's $500, $600, $700.
Yeah.
And then you got to think about the cost. How long is it going to take to earn that out? Things like that.
Yeah, there's a certain irony. I wanted to get all the stuff for Planescape, and I saw that it was selling for $200 for a rando supplement. I'm like, I'll get it print on demand. And now I suddenly understand why I can't, because it's $200.
Right.
So strange economic incentives.
And Planescape in particular is so, the original books were so high quality and so dense on the artwork that scanning them is a real project.
Much like Kindred of the East, where you have very detailed backgrounds.
Yeah.
So if you have time for two more questions.
Sure.
One, how has piracy changed? I am always disheartened slightly when I'm looking for information on a book. I do a Google search, and a illegal copy on Scribd pops up immediately. Has your tools of dealing with people illicitly passing around PDFs and such changed?
So we know that piracy is going to happen. So our goal is to offer better quality digital versions at a reasonable price, especially when we do sales. Like we just had the big Black Friday sale, and Christmas in July is coming up next year. So for people that are price conscious, we try to give them a chance to get the books. And we also tell people that buying the books, even on sale, helps us make more books. Piracy, we get none of that.
You get $0, yeah.
Right. And we're not trying to battle pirates, because we would rather be making new books.
Yes.
But the economic reality is the less books we sell, the less new books we can make.
And my last question is, as the person who also runs the Storyteller Vault, or is notionally in charge of that, how has that been changing since we last spoke at Gen Con?
Oh, it's been super fun. Okay. Right now we're running the Year of the Road. If you remember, like, Year of the Ally and Year of the Hunter back in White Wolf Revised, 3rd edition days, this is a thematic callback to those events where anybody creating content on Storyteller's Vault can create a Year of the Road supplement about travel and highways and byways, and the monsters you meet in the shadows of the World of Darkness. And it's just a themed event, really fun. We've got some really great, there's a brand new anthology called Darkened Streets, which has stories by David Niall Wilson, Bill Bodden, Aaron Rosenberg, and all about the shadows and highways and monsters you can meet. And then there's a Errant Knights, which is a nomad sabbat pack that you can drop into any of your games. So it's just a really fun way to create really cool stuff. Vagabonds is a new mage supplement.
I do like the opening of that one, because it goes like, oh, coincidentally, no one's really noticed these people before. And I'm like, yeah.
Jesus. Exactly. So Storyteller's Vault has been growing really, really well since we talked last. And people are coming up with very fun, creative stuff. So definitely drop by, check it out. Create stuff for yourself, too. Jump on the Facebook discussion group. We've got some very experienced creators and freelancers that are willing to offer advice on creating your first project. And just have fun with it.
Okay. Matt, thank you so much for your time. This has been
delightful. Thank you. This is awesome.
Hi, Mage fans. This is Terry Robinson talking with Travis Legg. Travis, how are you doing?
I am excellent, Terry. Thank you so much for having me on again. It is always a pleasure to talk to you. We are here at lovely PAX Unplugged in Philadelphia, PA. It's my first time. I'm having a riot, and I get to meet you in person. This is awesome.
For me, it was a 22-minute bike ride to get here. How about for you?
So I had to take an hour and 30-minute bus ride from glorious Rockford, Illinois, to O'Hare Airport in Chicago, where I spent 2 hours enjoying the local odor of O'Hare before I hopped on a plane to Philadelphia and then a train to basically the basement of the convention center, which
was nice.
It's
pretty convenient in that regard.
That was cool. And so that was my journey to get here.
Okay. Yeah. And you've been running demos, I imagine. Is there anything that you've been, what have you been hammering away at while you're here?
Yeah, so mostly been running demos. I ran Guardlands, which I'm super proud of and could talk about all show along if you let me. I did run a Legend Lore demo, which is also a 5e setting. Onyx Path has licensed from the Legend Lore and the Realm comics.
Okay.
Which is really cool. If you haven't checked those out, please do. The elevator pitch is you, the real world you, as in Terry that I'm talking to at this table, falling through a portal into a fantasy realm.
Okay.
And you become this fantasy character, and that's Legend Lore. So I got to run a demo of that, which was a lot of fun. People really got into it. It's the kind of thing that if you have the buy-in, everybody's going to have a blast.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, just that and Scarredlands have been largely my focus at this con. So it's nice to sit down and be able to talk a little bit about Mage because, as we know from my previous visits, I love Mage.
Yeah. And speaking of which, you are one of the most prolific authors on the Storyteller Vault.
So my entire Storyteller's Vault contributions, this is literally me guessing, probably 20.
Okay.
I would ballpark it at around 100 DMs Guild, probably 10 on Canis Minor, probably 20 or 30 on Solarician Vault. That's the Scarredlands community content.
We're going to see you on Story Path Nexus too. Has that started to happen yet? Or?
I do have one on Story Path Nexus so far. And then the rest are probably from Aegis Studios, mostly from Aegis Studios. And then I'm sure my name comes up on all the Onyx Path work I've done.
All the stuff that you've participated
in. Yeah,
I
mean, so yes, I am prolific, but I've been in the business for a long time. So that leads to a lengthy resume.
Is it just something where you have a running list of projects that you would like to work on? Like what spurs a new project for you?
It depends. Some of them are like sort of wish list ideas that I would like to tick off. Some of them come up like at a table and, you know, I'm running a scenario or whatever and I go, you know, hey, I could spin this out into five other things and then just make a book out of it.
Okay.
And some of them are, I'm a big fan of exploring the areas that are hinted at and not detailed in existing settings. So when I am reading through a book, you know, whether I'm prepping for like a game I'm running or prepping for a stream or prepping for another freelance project I'm working on, as I'm looking through the books and the materials and I see like this little area where there's a hook but there's no meat on that hook, I am compelled to put meat on that hook, and often that winds up turning into a book for the Storyteller's Vault.
So you've produced all of these publications. Do you consider it mostly a act out of love at this point, or is it something where you have been, I guess, pleased with how your work has been received and remunerated by the community?
I don't see that as a either or, really. It's paying my bills. This is what I do full time. Very recently, this past year and a half, probably, this is really all I do full time. I try to approach everything that I'm not working on as a contracted freelancer as for the love of the work. And if it makes money, awesome. I've gotten very good over the years at producing quality projects for very little overhead. I see people invest an awful lot of money in their project, and I would never do that because I think there are better ways to invest. I think if you're going to dump a large sum of money into creating something, that should be something that you have a more personal investment in. And I think that the assets that are provided for creators, particularly on the Storyteller's Vault, are amazing. So why would you spend money on art when you already have such awesome art at your disposal doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But, you know, I'm also not the guy to slap the dice out of somebody else's hand. So I have the luxury, I guess, of creating out of love in those regards. Nobody is in this business to get rich. I'm fortunate enough that I can subside in what I'm making.
You found a way to make it work.
Right.
So to me, when you list those other things that people wind up dumping money into, the two that seem to suck up the most additional money are probably editing and art and layout. So do you have any recommendations to people as far as getting stuff edited? Because I see a lot of stuff in the vault that has what I'll politely say a lot of heart, but right. maybe it's someone's second language or they're not used to writing for an RPG book.
Here's what I'll tell you. If you're going to spend any money anywhere,
okay.
spend it on an editor. The art, first of all, I know people don't like to hear this. It's an unpopular opinion. The art is the last thing that matters on your book. If you have clear text that is understandable, conveys what you want, and is compelling, you can have stick figures for art and it's still going to work. But if you have beautiful art and the text is gibberish and makes no sense and is not usable at the table, nobody's going to give a damn. So if you're going to put any money into it, put money into editing. Having said that, if you can't find an editor, don't know anyone that does it for pay, find someone, preferably someone who their native language is the language you're writing in, and preferably someone who is familiar with the game you're writing for, and have them proofread you. At the very least, have another set of eyes, because every designer I know, even those who have years of experience, we all fall into this blind spot with our own work where, of course, we know how this thing works. That's why we don't tend to playtest our own writing. We playtest each other's writing because you look at the page and you know what you meant when you wrote it. That's a bad litmus test for putting a project out in the world, you know, particularly when you're talking about a system as esoteric and mind-bendy as Mage can be at times, right?
And I've talked to a few people who are unwilling to go through that step because they didn't want the feedback. And then my reply is, then why do you want to put this out into the world?
Right.
So
exactly. Yeah. Use it at your home game. Enjoy it. And if you want to throw something up like that out in the world and put it on the vault, more power to you. But understand that what you're opening yourself up to is that feedback that you're not going to like.
Yeah, would you rather your friend write a nice email to you or you get a bunch of one-star reviews after someone shelled out $3 for something?
Right, exactly. People who are rightfully upset because they feel like they've gotten an incomplete product.
You know. And one of my concerns is it is a community content archive. There are a number of books that have started as amazing slash fiction and then became professional. But there's a lot of crap out there. And I feel as if, as a group, the more we can make sure that everyone else's stuff is up to snuff, the more the marketplace is going to be trusted as a place to get content. And I think it kind of helps everyone, the more polished everyone's stuff is. So speaking of work that you're doing as a freelancer,
sure.
One of them that I was excited to hear about is that you are working on Technocracy Reloaded.
Yes.
So what is Technocracy Reloaded, and is there any idea when we should expect it?
Technocracy Reloaded is a source book that details the Technocratic Union and brings it in line with the gameplay rules, mechanics, and setting conceits of Mage 20th Anniversary Edition. Technocracy Reloaded was mentioned during the M20 Kickstarter. It was the last stretch goal that was not met.
Oh, okay.
So, and there has been some very vocal support for it. We got very close to it. And in the interim, a lot of people have been clamoring for this book. It will be coming out hopefully within the next year, but we don't do, you know, we don't do dates, you know that.
Yeah, Onyx Path time.
It's soon trademarked to answer that desire, to answer that need, giving everybody kind of the full overview of what the Technocracy is in the context of M20. And so that means you're going to get the same sort of treatment that you've seen in all your other M20 books regarding, you know, your future fates and your, you know, all the meta plot stuff. And there's some interesting spots within the Technocracy where that is heavily affected that we get to explore.
So two or three that come up off the top of my head is in the Technocracy is in an interesting position in that it is the only group that got an update between Ascension being published at the end of Revised and M20 in the form that we got four convention books
right.
that came out in the early 2010s.
Right.
And one of the things that's listed in there, for instance, is that the Special Projects Division, no one's heard anything from them. Is that the example? So Special Projects Division was a group within the Syndicate that was working with Pentax, which is a worm-infested and worm-controlled entity from Werewolf. And the idea was the dimensional anomaly hit, they lost contact with it, all of those people disappeared. Is that an example of something that says, hey, a future fate, you can say, yep, they disappeared and they've been replaced. Yep, they disappeared and they've come back. Or they never went away.
To clarify that a smidge, sure. That is touched on a bit in M20.
Okay.
So a lot of this stuff is touched on its surface level in M20 through those future fate sidebars.
Okay.
So what you get in Technocracy Reloaded is going to be deep dives, some alternate sort of forking paths, more options, more ways to bring that to life at your table.
So maybe something that was previously two sentences in a sidebar is now maybe a page or something.
Right.
Okay, they've gotten much larger.
Where you've got more detail, a thicker view of what's going on, more options for, because due to space constraints, yes, even a book that's 900 pages that you can use as a home defense weapon does have a space constraint, oddly enough.
Are you making fun of M20 Core?
I would never. The point being, though, is that so this gives us the opportunity to really, because M20 has to serve all the factions of the Ascension War, whereas in Technocracy Reloaded, now we can really dive into each faction of the Technocracy, so each of the conventions, as they sit sort of in the core setting, but also really look at what those future fates mean, re-examine what this organization that was designed originally, because if you look at the history of the Technocracy, right, they were originally designed to be kind of the bad guys.
They were
right?
the antagonist.
Right.
Of
they,
the setting,
they were
yeah.
they were the villain. And then as it goes through the iterations of additions and developers, that's shifted in terms of A, obviously the bad guys are really the Nefandi, and B, looking at the Technocracy, it's very difficult to pin just raw villainy on them.
Often I say that the Technocracy has villainy as a side effect. Their right. goal is to make reality safe, and that happens to involve eradicating the traditions, where the Nefandi are like, no, we just want to break everything.
Right, so. Exactly. Yeah, that's a fair breakdown. And so looking into some of those motivations, and also looking into some of the, one of the things that was most interesting to me when I came on, is looking at the challenge of a world where, from a certain point of view, if you look around you, not to wax horrendously political on your show, but if you look around you from a certain point of view, the Technocracy's stated goals appear to be very successful right now. Seeing those stated goals usurped by the most foolish, like idiotic, careless, senseless people, I can just imagine the inner circle looking at the propaganda machine that has gone on with the American political system in the last 4 years, the American president, the American Congress right now, and scratching their head going, how are these morons making this function this way?
And to make it less local, we can say the same thing about the Great Firewall of China, or we can talk about Viktor Orban, or yeah. we can talk about Boris Johnson in the United
exactly.
Kingdom.
Exactly.
So no one has a monopoly on stupid right now.
Right, exactly.
So.
Right. It seems to be going around, right? And you can look at this. It's very easy to envision a world where you look at this and you go, the Technocracy is going, oh crap, the kids got the toys and they don't know what to do with them. You know, how do we rein that in?
Yes.
How do we rein that in using our tools?
In the words of Matthew Dawkins, modern propaganda is vastly more vulgar in both senses of the word than seemingly anything the Technocracy was ever able to do. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So that was a very compelling element for me to explore. I love digging into that. And looking into what sort of extreme measures might the Technocracy have to employ. Industrialization, almost inarguably technocratic invention, or technocratically motivated, right?
Yes, certainly supported at minimum.
Supported, yes. Now that's gotten out of hand. And we got to fix it quick, right? Climate change is it's the world killer, and the Technocracy knows it. How do we fix that? Sure, there's going to be all sorts of discussion of radical procedures in order to reverse the effects and so on and so forth. But there might also have to be some boots on the ground, and maybe, just maybe, somebody who's refuses to stop deforesting down in South America might have a visit from a very angry cyborg with a chain gun in his shoulder. You never know.
Yeah.
So, and that certainly flips the table on what we expect from the technocracy
right.
for so long, where we kind of presumed that there was going to be this technocracy civil war that occurred, that the New World Order and the Syndicate were going to finally come to blows, seemingly, as one had been replaced by the other in terms of power. Is that a topic that we get any resolution or insight onto?
All of the plots that sort of were leading in that direction will definitely be addressed. And the other thing I'll say, too, is like one of the things that was most awesome for me working on the book was getting to work directly with Satyros. I'd worked for him before doing some fiction.
Okay.
But this was the first time I really got to like have extended like conversations with him about the world of Mage in general. And so I got to get a little bit of insight into how like elements that have been seeded from Mage 20 through every book are pulled into resolution in Technocracy Reloaded. So this is kind of, in many senses, the big payoff for a number of sort of hanging threads will be there.
The way you're describing it with the usage of Future Fates, is there considered to be a canon meta plot anymore?
To the best of my knowledge, that hasn't been a thing since M20. There's kind of the suggested middle of the road meta plot, and then you've got all of your, you know, the things that are covered in the sidebars. Mm-hmm. The whatever happened to these people and,
okay,
you know, the Future Fates.
So as opposed things to, like, say, Vampire, which got Beckett's Jihad Diary, which was just a 500-page explanation, right, of everything you missed while you were away. Mage has no plans for really anything like that, to be much more open world.
To the best of my knowledge, no.
Okay.
And part of the reason for that, I think, is that it's easier to do a Beckett's Jihad Diary in a setting where ultimately reality is what reality is. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Mage, depending on how cosmic you want to get with your Mage campaign, all of those things might be true simultaneously.
Okay. So do you have a tentative idea how thick this guy's going to be? Book of the Fallen came in at 225, I think, page count wise. Is Technocracy Reloaded? Any idea how large that's going to be?
I think it's going to be around, barring anything that I'm unaware of, like on the Kickstarter side, I expect that we'll be prepared to release a book around the same size.
Okay.
Possibly a little bigger. I know that we're planning to do Kickstarter for it. I know that there will very likely be some additional materials that may be reached,
okay,
during, you know, stretch goals at that time.
So this is one of those things where you made mention that it's going to come out on Kickstarter. And when I think of Kickstarter, I think stretch goals. So is this a possible opportunity for us to get more M20 books beyond the two that seem to be planned?
Conceivably. I mean, I don't know beyond the fact that it's intended to go that route. Those are all decisions that are made above my pay grade.
Got it.
And far above my pay grade once we start talking into Mage, you know, because of the way that relationship works. Every decision that gets made about that has to go through a number of people now. I'm sure we would love to do a million of them, but we just don't have the ability to make those calls directly.
Understood. We're getting a new book. One of the things that's been most interesting about seeing the arc from Revised to M20 is the advent of a few novel systems in the game. So we have Primal Utility, which came into its own in Syndicate Revised and so on, and the idea that technocratic magic is kind of a different beast now. It's not just a reskinning. Are there any systems that you know of that we will see that we can expect that are kind of new for this baby that we can add to our tables?
Yeah, so one of the very big fundamental sort of philosophies that we have with M20 is to make sure that we're never bolting anything on that means that what you have in the M20 core book is invalid. Having said that, though, speaking as a guy responsible for a lot of the devices in the tech chapter,
okay,
very excited with the way that's going to be presented to you. Did a lot of work to make sure that some of the aspects of how technocratic magic functions are codified a little bit clearer. So putting together some language in world that is used consistently throughout the book to keep everybody on the same page about how things are referred to within the union. It's a nice thing to have. There's a little bit of stuff about in the devices section about hotshotting and, okay, working your stuff on the fly. Talking about how the paradigm of a technocrat works. And keeping in mind, many technocratic operatives are aware of the existence of these devices and what these devices do. Thus and therefore, they're aware, if they are properly schooled in the enlightened science behind them, they're aware of the principles by which these devices operate.
Okay.
So therefore, they can mimic the effects of these devices, provided they have the appropriate spheres and access to some sort of materials that they can reasonably jury rig into a
okay,
you know.
Oh, nice. So we're gonna
we will get systems for that, or at least guidelines on how to do that at a table.
Kind of walk through how that works.
Do we get any technocratic linear magic? Extraordinary citizens, so non-awakened practitioners, have kind of become to the forefront. It's been whispered a few times throughout mage history of high-tech hedge mages that were not necessarily like technostic, but actually advanced, super advanced technology practitioners. Do we get anything of that? Do you know?
As far as I'm aware, there has been a strict delineation of the linear magic from the M20 stuff.
Oh, okay.
And I think that's because when he was working on M20, Satyros really thought that that would need its whole kind of retreatment.
Okay.
But what we do get is a much clearer set of guidelines as to how extraordinary citizens interact with that framework.
Okay.
What you'll see is a little bit more of a guideline on what an extraordinary citizen can and cannot use, and how an extraordinary citizen may or may not interact with an operative's procedures.
Understood. Well, thank you for that little preview there. Is there anything else that you want to tease regarding Technocracy Reloaded that you're super jazzed about, or is that all you can say for now?
I'm going to get in so much trouble for anything I say on this podcast, but
Rich Thomas doesn't listen to it.
First of all, as soon as it comes out, please back it. Please, pretty please, with sugar on top, back it. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Okay. Secondly, I don't get to say this out loud, and it's still mind-blowing for me to say it. So, like, I am one of the developers on the book. I got development duties on the book.
Oh,
oh my goodness.
So that is a relatively exclusive club for mage.
It's Satyros is like a hero of mine in the industry. And they say don't meet your heroes. And this was the one time that's bullshit. He's literally as amazing a human being as he seems. And it was so amazing to work with him. So everything about the experience has been brilliant and beautiful. And I'm thrilled. There's a section in the book that is very dear to my heart that talks about alternate views. We talked a lot about future fates and things like that.
Okay.
And I think when it's at its best, Mage is a game about what do you want Mage to be about. It's a game about what do your people at your table, what does your group want the world to be, and what's the cost of making it that, and what's the benefit to you, and what benefit can you bring to the world around you? And with the state of the pseudo meta plot, I guess,
okay,
you know, the vanilla plot of Mage leaves a lot of stuff up to the storyteller by design.
Mm-hmm.
So because I like leaving a storyteller with more questions than answers at the end of the day, there's a sizable section of the book as of right now that details some options for where you can take your chronicle, some ideas for where to go beyond the bounds of what one might expect of a technocratic chronicle.
So it's almost a meta toolbox at that point. It's a tool on how to create tools for your game.
Oh, where to go past these boundaries.
Okay.
You know? And I'm really excited to see what people think of it. I'm really excited to see it in play. And there are some ideas in there that I think would be, any of which would be a beautiful coda or even just follow sequel to the world that Mage players have been in for the last 25 years, or continuation thereof. Especially, you know, when I was designing this stuff, obviously job number one was make sure that it's Mage.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure it's the technocracy and make sure that it's accurate. Job number two to me was make sure that they're not mustache twirling villains while still being accurate to what technocracy is supposed to be. And job number three was reconcile the sort of tabletop role-playing game conceit that you should, if you're not playing the hero, you should at least be able to feel like you are.
Okay.
You should at least be able to, your character should think they are. In almost any situation, even if you're doing questionable shit, you should feel like you're the hero. You're doing bad shit for a good reason.
Yeah. Even if society wouldn't call you the hero, and even if your colleagues don't think it's somewhere deep down, you should have that feeling.
Right. You have your reasons, and you think they're justified. So that's not an easy balance to strike. I'm really proud of the work that was done to that end. I think that the book very much hits the mark. I think that's very much due to the work that the amazing writers on the book have done, as well as Satyros and Danielle Lazan, who's the other developer that worked on it besides me and Sater.
Now, in lighter news and things that are going out right now, possibly while this podcast is occurring, you manage the Twitch stream for the Onyx Path.
I do. I am the Twitch programming coordinator, I think is my official unofficial title.
So you had some initial goals that you wanted to reach when that started. I looked at it and I'm like, oh man, Onyx Path is doing this.
I'm curious to see where this winds up going. So can you give us a status report on like how you think Twitch is doing, like what shows you got, what's on the docket, what should people be looking for, maybe if they haven't looked at the channel in a month or two?
Sure, yeah. So we've got a lot of stuff going on. Things are going very well. The channel grew way faster than we thought it was going to initially.
Okay.
Partially because we'd never done it before. Like, I've been on the Twitch space for a while, but it's been very casual. I play mostly for fun on my own Twitch. I looked at the follower count that they already had just by virtue of having an Onyx Path channel and occasionally throwing up a video about, like, a Kickstarter. And they already had enough followers that it pretty much was a shoe-in for affiliate status. So we started doing the actual plays, aiming for 7-day-a-week content, hoping to get that by New Year's. We had that well ahead of schedule. And so now we're expanding the channel even further and kind of figuring out what year two is going to look like.
If people are curious about the schedule of what's currently going on, what's the best case way to find that out?
If you go to twitch.tv/TheOnyxPath, if we're not currently broadcasting, the schedule is up there. We're doing a redesign on the site. Hopefully by the time this show is live, it'll be up. But otherwise, in the next couple of weeks, we'll have this schedule posted static. On the description page as well, but also on the Onyx Path blog. Okay. On the Monday
it's
meeting
included
notes.
As part of the Monday meeting notes.
It's always there. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for talking at length with all the projects you have going. We wish you the best in terms of maintaining your status as a independent creator that is largely able to feed themselves.
Thank you. Congratulations
as being one of, I think, seven of those.
I think so. I think we just got endangered species status, actually.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. And when any of those texts come out, we look forward to doing anything we can to support those Kickstarters or to have you back on when those are out in the wild. Travis, thank you so much for your time and your work on these games.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a blast, as always.
Thank you for listening to Mage the Podcast. If you have any questions, email us at magethepodcast@gmail.com or shoot us a message on Twitter @MageThePodcast. You can join our Discord server at discord.me/MageThePodcast or through the Mage the Podcast webpage. You can listen to our show on directly through magethepodcast.com, on anchor.fm, on Spotify, or through iTunes. And until next time, bye!